I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the Vatican announced recently that a woman from the Mohawk Algonquin tribe will be canonized as a Catholic saint, the first Native American to be so recognized. Now, many Native Americans say this acknowledgement is long overdue, but others are troubled by the role the Catholic Church in general and this woman in particular played in converting Native people to Christianity. We'll have more on that story in just a few minutes. But first, we have a newsmaker interview with Housing and Urban Development Secretary Sean Donovan. President Obama announced a $25 billion settlement with the nation's largest mortgage lenders yesterday. The settlement is an effort to bring some relief to this country's struggling homeowners and hold five of the country's largest banks accountable for their role in the foreclosure crisis. And Secretary Donovan is here with us now to tell us more about this settlement and what it's all about. Welcome back, Mr. Secretary. We appreciate this opportunity to speak with you once again.
Great to be with you, Michelle.
Now, needless to say, the president is happy about this, and as a sign of its importance, he personally came out to talk about it. And I just want to play a short clip of what he said about this yesterday.
These banks will put billions of dollars towards relief for families across the nation. They'll provide refinancing for borrowers that are stuck in high interest rate mortgages. They'll reduce loans for families who owe more on their homes than they're worth. And they will deliver some measure of justice for families that have already been victims of abusive practices.
Mr. Secretary, I'd like to ask you to unpack some of this for us. I wanted to ask first, who will get relief under this settlement agreement? Is it only people who are affected by the abusive practices that the president talked about?
Well, Michelle, one of the things that is difficult about this is that these practices were so pervasive. You know, there's been a lot of focus on robo-signing, what happened to people right on the edge of losing their homes as they were going through the last weeks of the foreclosure process. But the truth is, when we really investigated this, what we found was not only that, which was widespread, but we also found early on in the process, when someone got 30 days behind, when they should have gotten a call from their lender to say, hey, what's happening? You know, we have some options available for you. When they reached out to their lender to say, I'm going through unemployment, something's happened with my medical condition, my wife or my husband. And so what we saw was folks who shouldn't have gotten into trouble, folks who should have been able to get some help early on that was both good for them and good for the lender, didn't get that help. And so it was very hard to go back and reconstruct exactly who were the people who needed to be targeted. So what we did is came up with a different kind of strategy. We do have payments that are available to families where there was direct, demonstrable harm. They can show, here's what happened to me. But we also said, you know what, these practices were so pervasive, we should help provide help more broadly to homeowners that are struggling, homeowners that are behind on their payments, homeowners that are current on their payments, but haven't been able to refinance because they're underwater to today's record low interest rates and save about $3,000 on average a year. So we decided to sort of broaden the scope of what we were trying to do to help those that were harmed, but also to help more broadly the housing market. And let's recognize, too, these practices, even if you live next door and were current on your mortgage and nothing happened to you, if you're next door to a foreclosure, you got harmed as well. So the impacts of this are very, very broad on neighborhoods, on families, in our housing market, and so we tried to get a comprehensive solution that would be targeted in the same way quite broadly.
And just to clarify what you're talking about the fact that the initial sort of impetus for this is that it was determined that banks were filing fraudulent court documents in thousands and thousands of cases, documents that were required by the courts before the banks could proceed with foreclosure. And what you're saying is that you don't have to prove that you were actually a victim of that particular practice to benefit from this. Is that right?
That's right, Michelle. And what I would say is, while a lot of attention has been put on exactly what you talked about, the so-called robo-signing, our investigations were actually much broader than that. We began at FHA, at HUD, in the summer of 2010, an in-depth investigation of our largest servicers for a range of servicing violations, the kinds of things that I talked about, which are really, foreclosing, moving forward on the process when you shouldn't have been in terms of foreclosing, but also things like not providing homeowners that are just getting into trouble the options they should get.
We're speaking with Housing and Urban Development Secretary Sean Donovan about that $25 billion settlement with the nation's largest mortgage lenders. It was announced yesterday. It's intended, as he says, to provide relief to current and former homeowners who may owe more on their mortgages than their homes are now worth. Mr. Secretary, you have to know that critics are already complaining that this is just window dressing. They say once you factor in the 750,000 homeowners who would be eligible for a settlement payment, that the amount each one would get is maybe $2,000. I just want to play a short clip from a woman named Nikki Dupuy of Cape Coral, Florida, and she talked to NPR's All Things Considered yesterday, and this is what she said.
Well, that's an insult. $2,000 generally doesn't even provide enough money to get into a rental property because you have to do first and last in a security deposit.
And part of her additional argument is that it really doesn't do much for people who've already lost their homes to foreclosure. What's your answer to that?
Michelle, it's really important that we're talking about this because there's some real misunderstanding about this part of the settlement. The fact is, what you have is people who are in very different situations. There's a set of folks that were harmed by these practices who may have, for example, had some fees they were charged that they shouldn't have been, or their paperwork was lost and it delayed them getting help but didn't stop them from getting help. And in lots of those cases, the harm was a few thousand dollars. And what we've set up is almost like a class action process where anybody within a certain group who had a mortgage that was in trouble at a certain time can get this kind of help with very little processing or paperwork or anything like that, a very simple process. But if your harm was much deeper than that, if you lost your home and you shouldn't have and the damage was $50,000 or $100,000 or $200,000, you have two other ways that you can get help. One is, we have set up by federal regulators a full process where you can come in, document the harm that was done to you at the cost of the banks. You get full compensation for that. And then third, nothing in this agreement stops an individual homeowner from going into court and going after a lender, whoever it is, for the harm that was done. So you have to see those smaller payments to a broad group of people in the context of different avenues that those families have that are already available to them as part of the investigations that have been done into this, these just egregious failures on behalf of the bank.
But more broadly, though, housing advocates say that they're happy about the provision of the settlement that says that these banks will now write down the principal amount. That's the amount of, apart from the interest, and I hope most people kind of know what that is. But we understand, and of course, many people, banks have been resisting writing down the principal amount, which is the sort of the base amount of the loan. But we understand that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are these, government-sponsored entities, and the FHA and VA, for the most part, are resisting writing down the principal on the loans that they control. So advocates are saying that 80% of Americans are excluded from what they think is perhaps the most powerful part of the settlement. And what do you say to that?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that they recognize how important this principal reduction piece of this is. There has been virtually no principal reduction that's happened through this crisis. We've made progress in a lot of other fronts on modifications, on refinancing. Principal reduction, even though across the spectrum, economists and others agree it's one of the most important things we can do to help families get the housing market moving again, it hasn't been happening. And so it is a big victory. We'll get about $30 to $40 billion of principal reduction that will happen as a result of this settlement. That is very, very important. But we also have to recognize that the settlement is only one step. It's only a piece of a puzzle. And part of the way I would describe that so folks can understand it is, if you think about the reckless behavior that led to this crisis, the damage was created when these terrible loans were originated and securitized. While the servicing practices that we were really the issue that we settled yesterday increased that damage, they worsened it, they didn't create the damage in the first place. And so what should be clear to folks is that even though there's hundreds of billions of damage that was done, this settlement is a very, very substantial payment for those irresponsible banks to have to make as a result of these practices. And in fact, if you look at it this way, this is the largest settlement of the entire financial crisis thus far. It's the largest federal, state, settlement that in the history of the country. So it is very, very substantial.
Okay.
On the other hand, we're not going to stop there. The president announced a few weeks ago in the State of the Union a joint federal-state investigation that's going to continue to go after the banks for those origination and securitization practices, which is really what caused most of this damage. So we're going to be aggressive going forward after that.
All right, Mr. Secretary, we lose you in about a minute and a half, so I just want to ask you finally that this crisis has fallen very heavily on communities of color, as I know that you know, and I'd like to ask specifically about whether you believe that the settlement will offer relief to this particular group of people who seem to have paid a very heavy price.
Absolutely, because, as you rightly say, the damage was so intense in communities of color. Before the president even walked into the Oval Office, Latino families, for example, had lost two-thirds of their household wealth just in 4 years, between 2005 and 2009, largely because of the housing crisis. And so the relief, in turn, will be very targeted to those families and those communities. But the other thing I'd say, Michelle, recognize, again, this was focused on the servicing practices. We are not releasing, as part of this settlement, any criminal liability, any civil rights or fair housing claims. In fact, we announced just a few weeks ago the largest fair housing settlement in the history of the country with Countrywide for their just egregious practices against minority homeowners. And so we're going to continue to be aggressive about those claims, that ability to go after these institutions for those other things that really damaged minorities.
So we have more to talk about. We do hope you'll come back and speak with us again. Sean Donovan is the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and he was kind enough to join us from his office in Washington, D.C. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much.
Great to talk to you again, Michelle.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we'll check in with the Barbershop Guys about a controversy involving a CNN contributor that raises questions for some people about free speech. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, it's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. The Vatican recently announced that a 17th century Mohawk woman will be canonized as a saint. This will make Kateri Tekakwitha the first Native American to be so recognized. Now, many Native Americans say this is a long overdue honor, but others are not happy about this news. We wanted to know more about the woman known as Lily of the Mohawks, so we called WCPN's Brian Bull, who's been covering this issue for some time. He's also chair of the group Native American Public Telecommunications. Brian Bull, welcome back. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
Now, however you come out on this story, whatever side you're on, she is a fascinating figure. So could you just tell us a little bit about her?
Sure. She is very fascinating. Kateri Tekakwitha was born in 1656 near what's now called Auriesville, New York, along the Mohawk River. Her father was a Mohawk chief. Her mother was an Algonquin woman who had converted to Catholicism. And when she was four, there was a deadly smallpox outbreak that killed her parents and brother. And she herself survived, but was left scarred and partially blind. In fact, she was called among some of her tribesmen, she who bumps into things or she who finds her way with her hands. She came into the custody of her uncle, who was the Mohawk Turtle Clan, who repeatedly disliked Christianity. In fact, it's said that he removed some rosary beads from her that had been given to her from her mother. But this only drew out her interest, intensified her interest in Catholicism. And she began Catholic teaching in secret as a young adult. She was eventually baptized by a Jesuit missionary when she was 20, and took the name of Kateri, which is the Mohawk pronunciation of the name Catherine. Mm. And she performed penances, which included things such as sleeping on thorns while she prayed for the conversion and forgiveness of her people. And, you know, the Iroquois and Mohawks had also done the practice of piercing the body to draw blood, but Tekakwitha believed that doing so was a way to personify Christ's crucifixion. A friend did eventually object to this, and so she switched apparently to walking on burning coals, but she remained quite devout through her life.
And I understand that, of course, it's a very long process to become a saint, but it involves miracles, so one has to document that miracles are attached to the veneration of this person. And I understand that the particular miracle here was that a young Washington State boy recovered from a rare flesh-eating bacteria that could have killed him. And this is attributed to the fact that one of the nuns caring for him put a medal of Kateri on his pillow. So there's that side of the story. But Brian, I want you to tell me about why it is that there are people who are not happy about this. Is it because of her as a particular character or figure, or is it more broadly anger at the role that the Catholic Church has sometimes played in Indian country?
That's an excellent question and not a very easy one to answer. There are many different viewpoints about this. When she died, this is actually an instance of what some people consider the first miracle. The blemishes on her body and face reportedly disappeared. And then it's also said on some accounts that mourners at her funeral also found themselves cured of various ailments, and so they consider this the first miracle per se. That was in 1680. Now, flash forward ahead to a small town in northeast Washington State, Ferndale, and yes, we have a young boy. His name is Jake Finkbonner. He's playing basketball. He splits his lip on the basketball hoop, and that same night comes down with a raging fever, and his face swells. And as you've said before, it creates a terrible infection. The bacteria is known as strep A. It causes a disease called necrotizing fasciitis, which destroys skin and muscle and gives people a 50-50 chance of survival. And as you said, a sister, Kateri, comes and places a pennant, which is attached to his pillow. And it's at about that very same time that the family says that the disease stops progressing. To that point, they've been removing skin from the boy's face and chest to stay ahead of this infection. But in fact, it stops, and they tie it to the exact same day that pennant is placed. Oh. And so 2 months later, Jake gets to go home, and the Vatican begins its investigation and looks into potential sainthood because a local priest has submitted this case to the Seattle Archbishop, and the paperwork goes to the Vatican as reviewed by a committee.
But on the other hand, then there's this interview that you had with Ryan Rice. He's a Mohawk Museum curator who organized an exhibit around different interpretations of Kateri's story. I'll just play a clip from your reporting. Here it is.
The fairy tale looks at how Catholicism was something that saved her from her own evil people. The understanding of she came from a pagan existence and was civilized from a savage to a saint.
So again, Brian, the question is the resentment or the unhappiness about this about her per se, or is it more broadly about all the other things that you've reported on over the years, the Catholic boarding schools and some of the abusive behavior that people experience there? We only have about a minute left, I'm afraid.
Oh, sure. There are, of course, many Native Americans who celebrate this news. There are those who are very critical of the Catholic Church, and they see that this canonization of Kateri as something as trying to gloss over or whitewash history, because the Catholic Church did run a lot of controversial boarding schools from the late 1800s through the 1970s, where there are reports and accounts of children being taken away from their families, subjected to various abuses. And then, you know, many people see Christianity as a way of eroding their traditional culture and religion as well. And so there are many Native people who say this is a wonderful thing, this is an event to celebrate, and there are many others who simply say, no, the Catholic Church has to do more than this. They have to atone for this history they have with Native cultures across the Americas.
Brian Bull, it's a fascinating story. Thank you so much for bringing it to us.
Thank you, Michelle. Good talking to you.
Brian Bull is a reporter with member station WCPN, and he joined us from their studios in Cleveland, Ohio. Brian, thanks. Now we have another conversation touching on matters of faith and spirituality, or in this case, the cost of questioning faith. On this program, we've spoken before about African Americans who do not embrace organized religion. And this is interesting because religion and spirituality have played such an important role in the history, life, and culture of African Americans. Well, this month, for Black History Month, a group called African Americans for Humanism have launched a national advertising campaign. The group hopes to inform people that although a majority of African Americans are religious, not all African Americans are. Now, you might have seen the ads. They've been placed on public transportation and billboards in major cities around the country, and they feature historical figures like Zora Neale Hurston and Frederick Douglass, as well as people who belong to local chapters of the group. One ad features a picture of the poet Langston Hughes alongside Alex Jules of the Dallas-Fort Worth Coalition of Reason, and he's with us now to talk more about the campaign and his views. Alex, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What is humanism, by the way? Why not just say atheists?
There's a little bit of a difference. Atheism only tells you that we don't believe in a particular deity. Humanism, however, is a worldview that's concerned with humanity and the human condition. That typically doesn't have a mandate of belief of a deity. So atheism just says, I don't believe in God. Humanism tells you what you do believe in.
Hmm. What is the intention of the campaign? What do you and the others who are participating in it hope to accomplish with it?
It's about promoting discourse within the African-American community about Black freethinkers to inform them that we have always been here and we are still here. You know, what you see in the media or what's portrayed in general African-American culture, there is an alternate state.
I was interested to know how you came to your embrace of humanism. What's your story?
I grew up, for the most part, Catholic, going to church, mass, two, sometimes three times a week. I didn't question. When I did have questions, I was told by the priest, don't question, just take it on faith. And as I got older, that particular line of thinking got harder and harder to justify. I would go to church and I would see people speaking in tongues, catching the spirit, and I would never be moved in that sense, which also made me feel somewhat broken, which actually drove me deeper in trying to justify my faith and connect with God, etc. And it never really happened, which is interesting because it's, you know, I'm partnered with Langston Hughes, and his story is very similar. He talks about going to a religious revival and seeing all this and not being able to really experience it. And so that level of aloneness that we felt really drove us to question and find an alternative.
And where did that search lead you?
My search led me to eventually being an atheist, and I don't have an issue calling myself an atheist. A lot of Black people do.
I understand that I hope you don't mind my mentioning this, that you personally have paid a bit of a price for your embrace of humanism and your rejection of the religion with which you were raised. I understand that you really don't even have a relationship with your mother anymore as a result of this. Do you think that that's common, that people who are open about not embracing organized religion are ostracized within the African-American community?
Yes, especially in the African-American community because of the cultural importance of Christianity in the African-American community. You're typically seen as a race traitor, or you're seen as someone who just will not have any type of morality. For me, I don't have a relationship with my mother, my cousins, my extended family has turned their back on me. And that's a lot of the fear that some of the people that we know that are out there have. And
okay, can I just ask, though, how you know that that's common? Because African Americans are also known for being very tolerant of a diverse range of views and just saying, well, that's him.
Well, people have been reaching out to several of us across the U.S. electronically. And the common notion or common theme or question is, how do I come out to my family? I don't know if I can do this. You know, I can doubt. But as soon as I use the term atheist, it becomes very difficult. You become an apostate. Why would you want to come out as an atheist? Because of the social cost.
I understand. So finally, before we let you go, just want to mention again that the ads are running in New York City, Chicago, Atlanta, Los Angeles, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, Washington, D.C., and Durham, North Carolina. What reaction have you gotten to the ads?
It's been mixed. A lot of the preachers don't like the ads going up. Several of them have come out and says we have holes in our souls and we're crying out and we want to come back to religion and this is our way of finding our way back. But on the other side, we're seeing a swell of people that are connecting and saying, thank you for doing this because until now I felt alone. And that's really the purpose of the ads, at least in Dallas. It's to make sure that if you feel alone, you know that you're not alone. There are people out there.
Alex Jules is the chair of the Dallas-Fort Worth Coalition of Reason's Diversity Council, and he was kind enough to join us from Dallas. Alex, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And now it's time for Back Talk. That's where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere. Editor Ahmad Omar is here with us once again. Ahmad, what do you have for us today?
All right, Michelle, we're going to start with a women's health topic that's been in the news and we covered in our political chat on Wednesday. We talked about that decision by the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation to strip funding from Planned Parenthood and why they eventually reversed that decision. A lot of listeners wrote in to say our coverage was biased against Planned Parenthood. Lisa Kenyon from Euclid, Ohio, says it was the least balanced panel she's ever heard assembled on NPR. And here's Katrina Jones from Brooklyn, New York.
I found the panelists that spoke about the Susan G. Komen story to be negative and one-sided and frankly missing the big picture. They accused Planned Parenthood of going on a witch hunt. In truth, many people were outraged about Komen's decision, myself included. Thankfully, Komen heard our pleas and reversed their decision and frankly saved the lives of women who would have gone unscreened or would have been screened much too late.
Well, we appreciate all the comments, but I do have to say that we had four people on the panel, two of whom were conservatives and two of whom sided with Planned Parenthood. And I really shouldn't have to say this, but every so often I do. We think that our job here is to give people many different points of view, not just the ones that we think our listeners already have. Ahmad, what else do you have?
All right. On a lighter note, a couple years back, you spoke with then-Harvard basketball star Jeremy Lin. Michelle, you played some hoops at Harvard yourself for the old Crimson, so that's your guy. Anyway, here's a clip from that 2010 conversation. He's talking about some of the taunts he got from fans in college.
You know, stereotypical jokes in terms of, oh, go play the orchestra, or they'll yell out beef and broccoli or sweet and sour chicken. And sometimes I'll hear Chinese import, go back to China. Slanty eyes, can you see the scoreboard? So pretty much everything you could think of.
Well, after some time bouncing around the NBA and in the developmental league, Jeremy Lin is lighting up the scoreboard and the fans for the New York Knicks. Linsanity is taking Madison Square Garden and the league by storm. Here's some highlights from the MSG Network.
Fancy shot clock at 8, splits the defense again, gets to the rim, pucks it in!
Fan homage to this man.
But even it looks like his teammates don't believe what they're seeing.
I'll just take this opportunity to point out that my fellow alum went for 25 points against the Nets on Saturday. He then backed it up with 28 and 23 points in his next two games, putting a hurting on the Washington Wizards, I have to say, who play down the street from us, sorry to say, but and helping the Knicks to a three-game winning streak. So all those folks who had all those things to say, well, I think the phrase is called in your face.
Okay, last update. You spoke with the band Harana Beat in November. Update here, they just got picked up to play in the South by Southwest Festival in Austin next month. Good news for them and good news for you if you're in town for that festival. Let's hear some of it now.
Tengo mente, tengo alma y dos pies sobre la tierra. Tengo mente y tengo alma y dos pies sobre la tierra.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522 or visit us online at npr.org/tellmemore. Please remember to leave us your name. You can also find us on Twitter. Just look for Tell Me More NPR. Thank you, Ahmad.
Thank you, Michelle.
Just ahead, the Barbershop Guys weigh in on some hot topics of the week, including that controversial ad by U.S. Senate candidate Pete Hoekstra and the decision by CNN to suspend contributor Roland Martin over tweets his critics called homophobic that he said were all in good fun. That's all coming up in just a few minutes on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Nada más.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are freelance journalist Jimmy Israel, joining us from Cleveland, from San Diego, syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete, from New York, columnist and blogger Jeff Yang, and here in Washington, D.C., we have R. Clark Cooper with us. He's the executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans. That's a Republican group that advocates for LGBT issues, and he's also an Army Reserve captain. You can't see me saluting, but I am. Take it away, Jimmy.
Hey, Michelle. Thanks so much. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How are we doing?
Hey. All right.
Hey, good, man.
Coop, welcome back, man. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get things started by talking about the latest person to get in trouble because of their Twitter account. Journalist Roland Martin has been suspended by CNN for tweets he sent on Super Bowl Sunday. One tweet said, now remember, these are his words, not mine. Quote, if a dude at your Super Bowl party is hyped about David Beckham's H&M underwear ad, smack the ish out of him. End quote. Now, gay advocates have been taken into task. Now, before I weigh in on this, because you know I got some things to say. I want to hear what you guys think. Ruben Navarrete, you're a CNN.
Sure.
Just throw me into the hot
right. water. Thank you very much, brother. Now, I got things to say. But first, Ruben, you go.
You're a CNN contributor. You're a CNN regular. What's your take, brother? What's your take?
Well, first of all, keeping with the tradition I've had before of defending Juan Williams, talking about Juan Williams despite the fact that I'm employed by NPR, and talking about Rick Sanchez despite the fact that I'm employed by CNN, let me do it again, not knowing what's good for me. This is important. I am a contributor at CNN and someone who has worked with Roland Martin before. I have a lot of respect for some of the stuff he does, but you have to understand in the context of this, you've got to manage your tweets responsibly and realize that you reflect on the network that you work for even when you're not on the job. And if you take a certain tone that's sophomoric, and I actually listen and have read for months now a lot of Roland's tweets, and they sometimes sound really kind of childish and like you're in a locker room. And I think that it isn't just a question of being offensive, but you got to be professional. And he is one person, you know, on television, another person when he's tweeting. And I think that the problem here is they come together because, as we have seen time and again, there is no First Amendment free speech right for people who are employed by these companies, this one included at NPR. We all work at their pleasure, and we reflect on them, and they have a right to protect their brand. And let me also say, this is not just a question of tweets. When somebody lets somebody go, in this case CNN, there's always the story for public consumption, right? So the public consumption rap from CNN is that he was let go because of the tweets. You have to understand, there's a different management structure at CNN than there was when Roland Martin was first hired. And it's very likely that the new managers just didn't like his shtick, and they were tired of him already, and it was not working for them, and they were looking for an excuse, and he gave them one. So you got to be skeptical. Whenever the media tells you that, you know, we're doing this because of X, it's probably because of Y.
Okay, that's interesting.
Ruben, with a little inside baseball, Captain Coop, R. Clark Cooper. Now your organization, Log Cabin Republicans, you advocate for gay and lesbian rights. Were you offended?
Well, I'm going to go back to what Ruben said, is that I really think that, I mean, Roland himself, this is, I don't think there's any malicious intent there. Did it come off as anti-gay? Of course it did. But it goes back to policing yourself and having that internal governor or regulator in what you do. When I tweet, I'm not just tweeting for myself. I'm tweeting on behalf of Log Cabin Republicans and, in some cases, the Republican National Committee. I have to be very careful about what comes out of the Twitter sphere. I'm actually surprised when that came out that Roland Martin didn't regulate himself. It's almost as if he forgot that who he was professionally and that he detached himself. We see this with Facebook postings all the time.
Can I just clarify one thing? Just CNN suspended him, saying that Roland Martin's tweets were regrettable and offensive. Language that demeans is inconsistent with the values and culture of our organization and is not tolerated. And we've been giving careful consideration to this matter. And Roland will not be appearing on our air for the time being. So just to clarify, I don't know that he's been fired. I know that he has been suspended. But one more thing. He says that his reference to David Beckham was about soccer, not about sexuality. He says that he regularly rags on soccer, and that the issue is that he says soccer is not a real sport. It's lame. And that he's tweeted to that effect before.
Oh,
and
I just think I'm highly offended.
And you are highly offended. I thought you were a rugby man.
I am.
You
Don't
are a rugby man.
Locked on rugby defense on soccer.
Three quarters of the world right there.
I just think you just need to hear. So Jeff.
Stop digging.
Jeff Yang.
you know, okay, I gotta chime in and agree totally that, you know, I think people think that social media is somehow private and the internet somehow isn't listening, and it always is. I mean, especially right. Twitter, right? I mean, that's what you do. You're out there broadcasting the world, and it never forgets either. So this is something that's not going to erase itself, even if, you know, we with our human wetware brains forget it. I think, though, that, you know, one inconsistency I thought, you know, was out there is the degree to which I think some voices, I mean, I would say GLAAD did this, tried to kind of fashion this as about Roland Martin specifically kind of advocating violence, you know. And I'm not sure that he thought he was doing that. I think the bigger question and the bigger issue is that he was reinforcing this narrative that somehow being gay, being attracted to men, you know, if you're a male, is abnormal. And that's the bigger issue.
Well, can I just ask Clark this before Jimmy, because I know you have something to say about this. The other question I had, well, two issues here. One is that the other thing that was cited was that he defended Tracy Morgan, the comic, and he's also a star of 30 Rock, when he, you know, said something in his stand-up routine. I find that troubling, because are you saying now that you're not allowed to have an opinion? Yeah. Are you not allowed to have an opinion that other people might disagree with? And that's thing one. And then the second question I have is that, you know, Tuesday was National Black HIV AIDS Awareness Day. And there are some people who say, is this really the most important issue in the world that gay and lesbian activists could be focusing their attention on?
To clarify, let's say what Tracy Morgan said. He said that if he had a child who was gay, he would take out a knife and stab him.
I understand, but he said it in the context
of a stage.
He said this in the context of a comedy routine. He did not say this in a speech at the press club, Ruben.
If you substitute black or Latino for gay in that statement about stabbing them, the point here is that there is a file. Everybody has a file, and Roland had a file. The GLAAD organization had a file on Roland. They just were ready to drop the hammer. He gave them an excuse.
No, I get it, but
it's not just one thing.
But I totally understand. But I'm asking about that particular issue as being part of the narrative, because by that standard, why is Bill Maher and anybody's there? Because he defended Don Imus, who made comments I think we all agree were racist and offensive about these young women at Rutgers. My point is that people like Bill Maher defended him. So does that mean he gets drummed out of the commentary? Sorry, can I just let Clark respond to my question?
This goes back to several things. I mean, there's freedom of speech, and you are free to be disgusting. You are free to have thoughts that people don't disagree with. You're free to make offensive speech. The issue here is that this is a commercial enterprise with CNN, and they don't have to take Roland Martin's opinion. They don't have to pay for it, and they've chosen not to. And then let's look at the GLAAD organization. They are single issue focused. They're focused on media, media engagement, and discourse and dialogue in the media. So yeah, if you look at the grander scheme of things on bigger issues, this is really small potatoes when we're talking about actual issues that are being debated on Capitol Hill, actual issues that are being addressed in policy in state houses. So, you know, there is bigger news items, but, you know, this is GLAAD's meat and potatoes. So
I hear you. Good point. Jimmy had something to say on this.
It's just ironic for me that the vanguard of the pundits who was trying to get Don Imus' head back in the day, he finds himself suspended for exercising his free speech. Now, off the clock for the win. But anyway, moving forward, if Roland made a mistake here, it was his belief that his Twitter followers were all familiar with his peculiar signifying rituals. You know, and signifying rituals you'll find in any barbershop among black men. And also, its intention. Clearly, his intention was not to be homophobic. Clearly, his comment didn't have anything to do with gays or lesbians. CNN acted too fast. GLAAD ought to be ashamed of itself. It's really it's a bad look on everybody. It's awful coming and going.
Can I ask you, how can they act too fast?
They dropped the hammer on Imus. We dropped the hammer on Sanchez. We dropped the hammer all the time.
But wait a second. You pointed out Imus. Imus took some deliberation. Imus didn't get fired immediately, and he didn't even get fired. They paid out his contract, and then he came back a year later.
But Ruben said
Roland has not been fired. I mean, again, he's
Rick Sanchez was
indefinitely.
We'll see how long that lasts.
You want to talk about immediate reaction? I'm glad Ruben mentioned Rick Sanchez, because he was fired, and there was very little. There was no leave time. There was no taking a breath. I mean, he was shown the door immediately.
Okay, well,
those comments were clear cut. I am going to go there because Roland's constituents knew exactly what he was talking about. It didn't have anything to do with gays or lesbians.
Jimmy, you can't even say definitively what Rick Sanchez said, let alone say it's clear cut. You couldn't recount it. You couldn't say it exactly what he said. I've looked at that transcript many, many times. The point is, and here's where African Americans and Latinos have to be very careful. We cannot set up one standard of rules when we're offended, but then go off and offend somebody else. And then now all of a sudden we sound like the white folks who are criticizing us when we are oversensitive. It doesn't
I'm one of the people that tried to get people to get off Don Imus's back, because I knew that when if you went for his free speech, they would come for yours, and it came to pass.
Well, okay, there you go.
All right. Well, there you go. And I'm overly sensitive about the clock, so I'm going to move on right here. If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. You're having our weekly barbershop mud wrestling match. I'm sorry, I thought it was a round table. Sorry. We're joined by freelance
It's a real barbershop.
Freelance
right.
Jimmy Israel, syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete. Those are the ones who are scraping the mud off right now. Columnist and blog. I'm not saying you're mudslinging, gentlemen. I'm sorry. I meant you were mud wrestling. I thought your comments were perfectly within the bounds of appropriate discourse.
With good haircuts.
It's all good. Brotherhood. It's all good.
Columnist and blogger Jeff Yang. And from the Log Cabin Republicans, R. Clark Cooper. Back to you, Jimmy. Take a breath.
Thanks, Michelle. All right. Well, you know, gays and lesbian advocates weren't the only people offended by some so-called Super Bowl stupidity. A campaign ad that only ran in Michigan has people upset. Michelle, let's let the ad do some talking. We got some tape.
We do. And the reason you're talking about the Super Bowl is that Roland Martin's tweets came during the Super Bowl while he was watching the Super Bowl. That's why we're talking about that. And this is an ad, a campaign ad for a U.S. Senate candidate, Republican Pete Hoekstra. And in the ad, viewers see this young Asian American. Well, I don't know who. She's Asian. I don't know what her nationality is. She's on a bicycle. She seems to be in a rice field. She's very pretty, if that's relevant. And some people think it is. And I'll just play a short clip. Here it is.
Thank you, Michigan Senator Debbie Spendetnow. Debbie spends so much American money, you borrow more and more from us. Your economy get very weak. Ours get very good. We take your jobs. Thank you, Debbie Spendetnow.
And the reason, she's referring to the Democratic incumbent Debbie Stabenow, and her opponent, Pete Hoekstra, has been calling her Debbie Spendetnow. So that's what that means.
Right.
Jimmy, go.
Wow. All right, Jeff Yang, you're the first. You get the
so
first
now
run of
switch
this.
Hats. I'm
in the chair, yeah.
is the Asian American blogosphere, are they blowing up about this?
Yeah, well, it's not just a blogosphere. I mean, this is obviously not something you should take in context either. We have seen, I think, in this political cycle, more of a demonization of China than we've seen in decades. And I think it started with 2010. I think people realized that, mm-hmm. you know, there was an easy target in China. It was something that people could kind of, you know, treat as this mysterious manipulator from the Far East. And both Democrats and Republicans have been guilty of that. But this particular exercise in absurdity and horror that is this ad. I mean, number one, pretty or not, this woman cannot act. And I can't do Asian accents for my life, but I could do a better one than her. She's clearly U.S.
born. A PhD from Stanford.
Yeah, exactly. Probably. You know, and I mean, she's clearly a U.S. born, you know, native.
English.
English speaking Asian American. So the blurry, scary line here is that we're seeing, you know, individuals who are clearly American and should be treated and seen as American being proxies for these sort of scary puppet masters from the East. And it's only gone wrong when stuff like that has happened in the past. It's only going to go wrong if this keeps on happening in the future.
Well, the only reason I mentioned that she's pretty is that some people think it's like this exotic, you know, trying to sort of play on her prettiness as an example. That's the only reason I mentioned it, because there are people who feel like – because everything about an ad is a constructed reality, right? I mean, ads aren't random. Do you mind if we go to Clark on this, because you advised Republican candidates yourself, and I'm just –
Well, I'll start with – you know, the ad is off of Pete Hoekstra's website, by the way. It's gone. He took it down. That was in response to what was happening even inside the conservative movement. Chairman Cornyn, who heads up the National Republican Senatorial Committee, remained what I would say resoundingly mum on this issue. There was no defense by the NRSC on this ad. So many folks within the Republican ranks thought the ad was foolish. Hey,
foolish is different than offensive.
Well,
you could argue it's bad strategy, but so tell me what.
Foolish and offensive at both. And so, you know, take on Debbie Stabenow as a spender. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. Go after her record. You know, Citizens Against Government Waste have some great stuff that Pete Hoekstra could use and should use.
That stuff is messed up too. I'm sorry.
But let's talk about. There's a difference between going after Debbie Spendetnow's record and then using that ad. And so that ad was a bad ad. It was offensive. It was also bad tactically. And a lot of Republicans agree. In fact, at CPAC, I was asking Michigan folks who are there, who are in town this week,
the Conservative Political Action Conference meeting in Washington.
Right, and so even the Michigan attendees said they're like, God, there could have been a much better way of taking on Debbie Stabenow's record, and it should have been focused on spending and on her voting record, not this ad.
Ruben, what do you think?
I think that one thing that people have to understand is that when you're talking about a group like Latinos or Asians that are an immigrant group who oftentimes people have to learn English. At least English is not their first language as they come here as immigrants. The use of sort of this tricky English, this pidgin English, is the equivalent of in the African-American community, of blackface. You just never do it. You ought not do it. It sends that racist message to begin with. And the whole context of the rice field and everything is certainly about racism. And one of the things that I struggle with is that you have to recognize this long thread of anti-Asian sentiment that really goes back all the way back to the Clinton administration and some of the concerns about foreign donors then. We have been on this trip for a long time. You remember famously during the Clinton thing, Senator Brownback, who is now Sam Brownback, who is now governor of Kansas, when then senator, famously said, "No tiki, no laundry," you know, making a joke about that. If you go that
Vice
way.
Vice President Biden a few weeks ago with his accent.
Well, that was India, wasn't it?
Same
genre, folks.
Vice President Biden has said that about Indian immigrants on a couple of different occasions, as you recall, joking about them owning 7-Elevens and the like. Don't go there. Do not do that one, okay? You know, it's not a good idea, and it's really bad politics. But it's also bad for the country and bad for our dialogue.
You know, it's even worse, I mean, given the context of him being from Michigan, because, you know, Michigan is a place where if you want to talk about a ground zero for, you know, a lot of the most flagrant and painful episodes of, you know, kind of translation of anti-Asian-ness into violence have occurred. I mean, 30 years ago, a guy named Vincent Chin, who was, of course, Chinese-American, was murdered by auto workers for being, quote-unquote, Japanese.
We remember that, which he was not. So, Jimmy, you only have 5 seconds. Bad ad, good ad.
It's dog whistle politics at its worst. It's sad that that's where we are.
All right. Final thought from everybody. Thank you all. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist and presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University. He joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Jeff Yang is a columnist with The Wall Street Journal Online. He's a blogger for member station WNYC. He joined us from our studios in New York. Ruben Navarrete is a syndicated columnist who writes for The Washington Post Writers Group, Latino Magazine, PJ Media. He was with us from San Diego. R. Clark Cooper is a captain in the Army Reserve. He's also the executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans, a Republican group that advocates for gay and lesbian issues within the Republican Party. He was here with me in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Back to CPAC.
Yep, yep.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.